Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm going to cover in this audio Leviticus 12, verses 1 through 8, which will cover purification after childbirth. Our context is this. In our last chapter, 11, the whole chapter dealt with clean and unclean animals. So we begin now in Leviticus 12, verses 1 and 2. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, when a woman gives birth and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean for 7 days, as in the days of her menstruation she shall be unclean." Now here God is speaking to Moses. In the preceding chapter, he spoke to both Moses and Aaron. I don't know why only Moses is mentioned in this chapter, but John Gill says no doubt this law is meant to be told by Moses to Aaron, so we're not going to worry too much about that. So God tells Moses to tell the sons of Israel this rule concerning a woman giving childbirth: she shall be unclean for 7 days. Now, it would be tempting to read this and say, there's something dirty about having a child, and there's also something dirty about having sex to produce the child. No, that has nothing to do with this. This means she will be ceremonially unclean. The uncleanness came from the bleeding, not from the birth, as the NIV Study Bible says. And if you remember, the whole purpose of the law is to separate out blood separate from its ordinary use in human life, to separate out blood from that to from its sacrificial purposes, being offered for the life of the offerer in the sacrificial system. So this is just one more example of that. Has nothing to do with the fact that having children is dirty, morally dirty, or any other thing. It just has nothing to do with that. We have the same problem in chapter 15. When we get there, that chapter talks about menstrual bleeding, postpartum bleeding, and other feminine bloody discharges, and also male seminal discharges, having to do with sex and birth, and that blood makes, or that semen makes, the mother and father unclean. And so we say, see there, sex and childbirth is sinful. No. Menstruation and postpartum bleeding are obviously not sinful, but they are associated with the birth of a human being who is sinful by nature. That human being, that little baby, has inherited the sin which originated in Adam. So the purpose of the law was to remind Israelites that they were conceived in sin. Not that the sex act was sin, as Augustine so unfortunately said, but rather that they were born in the condition of original sin inherited from Adam. So blood is not supposed to indicate that sex is sinful, only that the baby is sinful. Point number one. And point number two, the whole purpose of this is not to show that sex was sinful, but to segregate blood out for its holy purpose of being a sacrifice in the sacrificial system. Also, we might add that the seminal emissions, which we will get to in chapter 15, they are, of course, associated with sex, and sex is obviously not sinful, but semen is associated with the birth of a human being who is sinful by nature. So just to summarize this, Leviticus wants to remind the Israelite of his sin, which originated in Adam. And point number two, Leviticus wants to keep sex completely separate from religious worship. Unlike the pagans who used religious prostitutes and had orgies in their religious services, we're not going to do that, because we're Israelites. Now, verse 2 here says that the woman shall be unclean, as in the days of her menstruation shall be unclean. The uncleanliness in the times of her menstruation is described in Leviticus 15, verses 19 through 24. I'll read that very quickly. When a woman has a discharge, if her discharge in her body is blood, she shall continue in her menstrual impurity for 7 days. And whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. So 7 days of impurity for a period, also 7 days of impurity for the birth of a male child. The menstruation is Leviticus 15. The male child is in Leviticus 12. Verse 20, Leviticus 15. Everything also on which she lies during her menstrual impurity shall be unclean, and everything on which she sits shall be unclean. Anyone who touches her bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Whoever touches anything on which she sits shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Whether it be on the bed or on the thing on which she is sitting, when he touches it, he shall be unclean until evening. So basically that means a woman has a period, she sits down on a chair, lies down on a bed, and if somebody else sits on that chair bed, they're unclean. Again, that's just to show the sub, we don't want to have anything to do there's not, it doesn't mean that the woman is morally unclean or the person sitting on her bed or chair is morally unclean. It just means that they can't participate in the ritual sacrifices. They can't have a peace offering, for example, because we want to keep blood separate from the blood that's being poured out of that bronze altar. Verse 24, Leviticus 15, if a man actually lies with her so that her menstrual impurity is on him, he shall be unclean 7 days, and every bed on which he lies shall be unclean. And that does not mean that the man is immoral because he had sex with his wife while she was menstruating. It just means that he needs to stay away from the peace offerings in the temple because blood is used separately there. This reminds me of a story. I had a friends, there was a couple, who were teaching natural family planning, which is a natural method of birth control. And in order to do this, you have to chart out the days on which you have sex so you can have sex on the right days to either have a baby or not have a baby. Well, somebody presented a chart to the woman who was presenting the presentation, and there was a little X there showing that sex was done during the period. So she puts that chart up on the overhead projector, and somebody in the stand says, "That's sinful. That's sinful. How can she do that?" And I remember being taken aback by that, and I couldn't come up with the answer. Well, the answer is there was nothing sinful about it. This had to do with Levitical uncleanness, not moral uncleanness. And besides, Christians today are not under the Old Testament law. So there's two good reasons why it's perfectly all right to have sex with your wife when she is menstruating. We go now to Leviticus 12, verses 3 and 4. On the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. Then she shall remain in the blood of her purification for 33 days. She shall not touch any consecrated thing nor enter the sanctuary until the days of her purification are completed. Before we get into the circumcision, let's look at the blood of her purification for 33 days. First of all, the phrase itself is a little bit confusing. The Bible in Basic English translates that as the days for making her clean. The blood of her purification is the days for making her clean. And I like that. That makes it clear what's being talked about. So she's unclean for 7 days already, but now she's unclean for another 33 days. Why the distinction? Well, it's not clear. This is not explained in the text. I'm going by Joe Sprinkle here, who's got some good stuff on Leviticus. This is his suggestion. The 7 days represent the completion of the period of the greatest impurity. The next 33 days represent the completion of all impurity for a total of 40. So after 40 days, all impurity is done away with. It's a gradation. I think that makes actually a lot of sense. After all, Jesus' temptation was over after 40 days. Israel's wandering in the desert was over after 40 years. And likewise, we can say the woman's impurity after the birth of a male child is over after 40 days. The first 7 days representing the period of greatest impurity. And remember, she's not impure because she's immoral. She's impure because she had a baby that was afflicted with original sin. Sprinkle has another idea. He mentioned it. I don't know if he agrees with this or not, because I don't think it's a good idea. He said 40 days is about the period of time necessary for the healing of the womb so he can have another baby, so it's good to go after 40 days. Well, I question that. A nursing mother will suppress ovulation for about 2 years, which seems to me to make the 40-day period somewhat irrelevant if a mother's not going to be having a baby that soon anyway. Maybe Sprinkle's right about that. I don't know. But I think the idea of 40 being 7, of course, is the period of divine completion. There's some cleanliness there, and then another 33 days just to make it totally complete would explain the 40 days. But at any rate, the woman is ritually clean after 40 days. She can participate in the peace offerings in the tabernacle and so forth. Until then, she shall not touch any consecrated thing, nor enter the sanctuary to have a peace offering meal, for example, until the days of her purification are completed. Now, why would she touch any consecrated thing? Well, if she were the wife of a priest, it was likely to happen. She might touch the priest's tithe. Somebody had given the priest a tithe, and she puts it in a safekeeping place. Well, and it would probably be easy to forget. Well, what day is it since I had that baby? Oh, there's some money. Oh, I just touched it. Well, now the tithe is unclean. What about if the priest brought home a wave breast or a heave right foreleg? The priest share in the peace offerings, and she says, "Oh, goody, let's cook some lamb tonight." Oh, she just touched the peace offering and made it unclean. The peace offering is consecrated, it's holy, and she made it unholy. All right, let's go back now to verse 3 and talk about circumcision. On the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. Why the eighth day? Well, first of all, let's note that circumcision had been practiced since patriarchal times. We read in Genesis 17:12, "And every male among you who is 8 days old shall be circumcised throughout your generations. A servant who is born in the house or who is bought with money from any foreigner who is not of your descendants, circumcised." Anybody, everybody, 8 days. This was in the time of the patriarchs, long before the law, so this was a codification of an earlier practice. Now, even past the time of Moses into the time of Jesus, that eighth-day circumcision was religiously observed, so much so that if the eighth day fell on a Sabbath, the circumcision triumphed over the Sabbath prohibition against work, John 7:22. "For this reason, Moses has given you circumcision, not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers," i.e. from Abraham, "and on the Sabbath you circumcise a man." So that was the practice. On the Sabbath they circumcised a man. Circumcision even beat the Sabbath. Now, the next logical question is why did the Jews wait until the eighth day in order to circumcise? Well, Judd Gill suggests a reason. He says the reason was the circumcision could be done when the mother was free from her uncleanness of childbirth, at least free from the first 7 days of it, so she could participate in the circumcision. I suppose if she were unclean, she would not be able to participate in the circumcision because she would be unclean. Well, the problem with that view is you still got 33 days of uncleanness when she's in the blood of her purification. So she still wouldn't be totally clean until day 41. So I don't think that answers it. I think it makes much more sense to me to explain this eighth day circumcision by a desire for safety. A baby's blood doesn't clot till after 8 days. You circumcise the baby before 8 days. Before the days of artificial administrations of vitamin K, the baby's going to bleed to death. Here's a quote from evidenceforthebible.com. "The human body has two blood clotting elements. One of them is called vitamin K. Vitamin K is not formed in the body up until the 5th to the 7th day. The second clotting factor, which is essential, is called prothrombin. It surprisingly enough develops to 30% of normal by the 3rd day of life, and after that, with seeming inconsequence, peaks at 110% on the 8th day, just before leveling off at 100% of normal. I've got a nice little chart here which you can't see, but it shows day 1 through 8, and it shows the prothrombin climbing up and peaking on day 8, dropping off thereafter, and vitamin K peaking on day 8 and then leveling off thereafter. So day 8 is the if you do it before day 8, you don't have enough prothrombin and vitamin K. If you do it after day 8, you have less prothrombin. So, there's your answer. Adam Clark, of course, he's writing in the 1800s before people knew this. Vitamin K wasn't discovered until the 1940s, I think I saw on Wikipedia. So Adam Clark couldn't know about this. He says that before this time, the child could scarcely be considered as having strength sufficient to bear the operation. Well, that's true. Didn't have enough vitamin K and prothrombin to bear the operation. Now, of course, let's don't forget, circumcision is a sign of the covenant, has been ever since Abraham. So, of course, Jewish babies are going to be circumcised under the law of Moses. We go now to verse 5 of Leviticus 12. "But if she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean for 2 weeks, as in her menstruation, and she shall remain in the blood of her purification for 66 days. Now, here we see that the purification ceremony for a female child just doubles the number of days for a male child. In other words, it takes twice as long as it does for the male child for the woman to become pure. 14 days after the birth, 15th day she's clean from that, and then 80 days after the birth, 81st day, she's totally clean. Now, why is this? Why the 80 days? The NIV Study Bible says it's unclear why. Joe Sprinkle has got an interesting idea, or he mentions somebody's idea that women are supposedly subject to stronger attacks by demons. What? Women are supposedly subject to stronger attacks by demons, so therefore when you got a baby child born, it takes 80 days to get her mother Levitically clean? I don't think so. Here's another idea. This 80-day, this double period, reflects the female's role as first in transgression in the Garden of Eden. She's doubly impure since she went first. Problem with that is that Adam took the blame for the first sin, not Eve. Romans 5, it was Adam who sinned. It doesn't say a thing about Eve. That's basic theology. So how are you going to say the woman is more, the female baby is more impure in her original sin? That's not going to work. Now, here's an interesting idea, again from Joe Sprinkle. The 80 days was a provision for the care of baby girls who would be less desired than boys. A girl might receive inferior care from thoughtless husbands because the husbands would rather have a boy, so they're not paying attention to the girl. But by this ceremony here, by requiring a man not to have sex for 80 days, that would leave a man free to take care of his daughter. I can see it now. Hey, baby, how about a little sugar? It's not 80 days yet. How about go change that little girl's diaper? That's great. I don't think that's the answer, but it is quite interesting. Now, here's another possibility, fifth possibility, actually, to explain this. Circumcising the boy baby on the eighth day somehow reduced the attendant uncleanliness because of the power of that ceremony. So, therefore, the mother was not as unclean, so she only had to spend 40 days in uncleanliness as opposed to when she had a female child, in which case she would be unclean for double the time, 80 days. No circumcision to get rid of the uncleanliness in that 80-day period because it's a female baby and not a boy baby. Now, the pulpit commentary back sprinkle up on this idea. The pulpit commentary says this: the reason why the duration of the mother's uncleanliness is twice as long at a girl's birth as at a boy's would appear to be that the uncleanness attached to the child as well as to the mother. But as the boy was placed in a state of ceremonial purity at once by the act of circumcision, which took place on the eighth day, he thereupon ceased to be unclean, and the mother's uncleanness alone remained. Whereas in the case of a girl, both mother and child were unclean during the period that the former was in the blood of her purifying, and therefore that period had to be doubly long. And I will point out here that pulpit commentary assumes that both the child and the mother are unclean. That is disputed. Some commentators say, no, it's not the child that is unclean. It's the mother that's unclean. I think Colin Delitzsch say that. Something else to argue about. Well, that's an interesting idea. The circumcision lessens the need for the length of purification. Here's another idea: that double period reflects the lower social status of women in ancient Israel. It took twice as long to be cleansed because a baby of the inferior sex was born. Adam Clark says of this argument, quote, this is a miserable reason and pitifully supported. Well, maybe so. Adam Clark's right. But remember, if we talk about inferiority of the female, we're not talking about inferiority of worth. We're talking about an inferiority of status. She wasn't the leader of the family, but she was just important to God. And you could say the same thing about a male Israelite. He's not an elder, a tribe leader. Therefore, he's of less worth than the tribal leader. Of course not. He's just lower in the hierarchy as far as status is concerned, not according to his nature as made in the image of God. So maybe Clark's a little bit harsh there, saying that's a miserable reason. That might be the reason. Here's another idea. This is idea number 7. Girls were destined to become a source of menstrual and maternal uncleanliness in the future, and so they must be doubly purified. In other words, girl baby in the future is going to bleed, and you know what the law thinks about blood. A male baby, boy, and when he grows up, is not going to bleed, so therefore the girl baby needs a double purification. Well, maybe so. Here's reason number 8 possibility. The longer maternal discharges after the birth of a girl as compared with that of a boy. In other words, some people say that mothers bleed more after they have a girl. Now, I'd like to see how that's backed up in medicine. I don't believe that for a minute. Reason number 9, the periodic vaginal bleeding of baby girls demands a longer period of uncleanliness. I never heard of baby girls vaginally bleeding. That sounds awful to me, so I can't speak to that because I'm not a doctor. I'm not a gynecologist. But I can say this, there's a lot of speculation on that double period, that 80-day period instead of 40-day period of uncleanness. Personally, I like the one where the circumcision of the boy speeds the purification up. We go now to Leviticus 12, 6-8, and we'll finish chapter 12. When the days of her purification are completed for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring to the priest at the doorway of the tent of meeting a one-year-old lamb for a burnt offering and a young pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering. So either at day 41 or day 81, depending on whether the baby is a son or a daughter, she has to do two offerings, a sin offering and a burnt offering. Burnt offering and a sin offering. Verse 7, then he shall offer it, that's the priest, then the priest shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her, and she shall be cleansed from the flow of her blood. This is the law for her who bears a child, whether a male or a female. But if she cannot afford a lamb, then she shall take two turtle doves or two young pigeons, the one for a burnt offering and the other for a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for her, and she will be clean. All right, this one-year-old lamb, that's a baby ram. Burnt offerings had to be male. Now, the interesting thing here is typically a sin offering is not a young pigeon or turtle dove unless the offerer is poor, but that's not the requirement here. It's just if it's a woman who had a baby, not whether she's poor or not. So that's a little deviation from the typical sin offering. Well, let's deal with that problem first. This is from Kyle and Delich. Quote, as this purification had reference not to any special moral guilt, but only to sin which had been indirectly manifested in her bodily condition, a pigeon was sufficient for the sin offering, that is to say, the smallest of the bleeding sacrifices, whereas a yearling lamb was required for a burnt offering to express the importance and strength of her surrender of herself to the Lord after so long a separation from him. So in other words, because this is a sin offering when the woman didn't really commit a sin, like other sin offerings are. She didn't really do anything wrong. She just had a baby. So we just have a tiny sin offering for her. I think that's a good answer. Kyle and Delich's answer there makes a lot of sense to me. Now, you might even ask the question, why is the sin offering even required at all? A woman hadn't committed a sin. As John Gill puts it, why is it sinful to bear children in lawful marriage where the bed is undefiled? Well, the answer, as John Gill says, is because sin, which originated in Adam, is being passed on to the child. As Adam Clark says, quote, it is likely that all these ordinances were intended to show man's natural impurity and original defilement by sin, and the necessity of an atonement to cleanse the soul from unrighteousness. So that's why it was necessary to have a sin offering, even if it was a tiny sin offering of a bird, dove, or a pigeon. When I talked about these bird offerings, talking about sin offerings in the earlier chapters of Leviticus, I made the point that doves were available in the time of the year when pigeons were not, apparently, and so that's why they had the option of using a turtle dove or a pigeon. Now, here's another possible reason. I love this. Another possible reason why a sin offering was necessary for a woman when she had a child. It was to cover the sin of saying something indecent during the pain of childbirth. And I've seen two commentators say that, one of which is John Gill, and I just think that's hilarious. Oh, because the woman said, leave me alone. Don't touch me. You know how women do when they're in the middle of childbirth. They say some nasty things. And so they need to have their sin covered. Well, sometimes I think John Gill has got an overactive imagination. I don't think that's the reason. The reason is because of original sin, and that child needed to be covered by the sin offering. Now, note the order here. In this passage, the sin offering is offered before the burnt offering is. Usually the sin offering is offered before the burnt offering is, but here the burnt offering is offered first. John Gill says the reason is not clear. Ellicott says the reason is that the more valuable offering is naturally mentioned first. The lamb for the burnt offering is more valuable, so it's mentioned first. That's no big deal. I'm not going to worry about that too much. Now, let's look at this burnt offering. It's a one-year-old lamb. The sex is not mentioned of the lamb, but we know from other scriptures that all burnt offerings had to be male. Leviticus 1:3, first part of the verse, if his gift is a burnt offering from the herd, that means a bull, he is to bring an unblemished male. Leviticus 1:10, but if his gift for a burnt offering is from the flock, from sheep or goats, he is to present an unblemished male. And chapter 1 is on the law of burnt offerings. So we know that burnt offerings have to be male. Now, what are some options as to why? Now, typically, people say, well, a burnt offering typifies Christ who gave himself up wholly to God, and Christ, of course, is male. Another option is, option 2, is the male is the stronger gender and therefore is more appropriate for a burnt offering because it better expresses the importance and strength of one's surrender to God. And I think that's the answer right there. Number 3, speculation as to why male burnt offerings were required, is that the male is less valuable than the female because males were just used periodically for breeding and females continuously produced offspring and milk. And therefore, God was going easy on the Israelites to say, hey, you can just put a male up because it's less valuable. Well, I think there's a couple problems wrong with that. Is I would think God would require the more valuable gender for a sacrifice of burnt offering, not the least valuable. Point number one. And point number two, can you really say that females are more valuable than males? Maybe. Okay, I'll go along with that, but that's questionable because, you know, you don't have males. You don't have babies. But just granting that, here's another problem. Why were females allowed for peace offerings? Now, it's true they were optionally allowed, so you didn't have to offer a female if you didn't want to. But if female animals were more valuable and you had the option of offering a less valuable male for a more valuable female, why would you not offer the less valuable male? Why did God make that optional? I don't think we're going to get anywhere with the one gender is more valuable than the other argument. The answer is, I think, the male is the stronger gender, and so it's more appropriate because when a male is sacrificed, it better expresses the importance and strength of one's surrender to God. The male is the leader of the sheep family, and he's the stronger of the sheep family, and so the symbolism is better with a male burnt offering. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished this short chapter of Leviticus 12. We are now prepared to move on to Leviticus 13 in our next audio. Leviticus 13, I'm going to have to split, I think. We'll try to cover verses 1 through 46 in the next audio, which deals with leprosy of the skin. The next audio after that will deal with chapter 13, verses 47 through 59, which deals with leprosy in garments. I hope you stay tuned for that scintillating discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this one.